Oh. The noise is coming from right over there, yeah. So, okay, I'm Lori. I'm a compulsive overeater. I want to recap a bit. We're on to step 8 and 9, but I want to talk about how we quickly went through steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Step 1, I discussed last night, I discussed today from the Big Book perspective, is the concept of the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. The allergy of the body is that our bodies get uncontrollable cravings when they ingest, when we ingest certain kinds of foods and we indulge in certain kinds of eating behaviors. And these uncontrollable cravings are not our fault. They're not things that cause, they're not our moral guilt or anything like that. They are our body telling us, overpowering our mind. So when we start eating things that cause us these uncontrollable cravings, we cannot stop. And our real problem, though, is in our mind, because our mind is a weird thing that keeps telling us we don't have this physical problem. We have an obsession that we can control and enjoy our eating. We have this thinking that is so ridiculous and insane that it overpowers our ability to say, no, I won't have this stuff. This stuff is not good for me because once I start eating it, I won't be able to stop. What the 12 steps do is get rid of the mental obsession. And they do this by, as we learn in step 2, getting rid of the things that block us from our core beliefs, whether they're deeply religious beliefs or whether they're things we believe in abstract ways, as I do. I just have very abstract beliefs. And so the despair that we get because we're in a vicious circle, the vicious circle is we can't stop once we've started. That's the allergy of the body. And we can't stop from starting again. That's the obsession of the mind. And that's a vicious circle. We might stop and then we start again. We might start and then we stop again. And we just go through back and back. And that's yo-yo dieting. That's my story. All my life. And the only way to break that vicious circle is to rise above it or to go down below it, but to get out of it is by getting rid of the mind that causes this problem. Step 1 then is the problem. And step 1 also gives us part of the answer. We must abstain from those things that cause us uncontrollable cravings. We have to develop a plan of eating that allows us that allows us to abstain from all the things which we in our hearts know, or as we learn over the period of time, cause us these uncontrollable cravings. And they can be foods, food ingredients, specific foods, specific ingredients. They can be eating behaviors. Whatever they are, we have to be honest with ourselves. And sometimes we're not all that honest with ourselves. And I was just talking to some people at lunchtime about, you know, some of my experiences with how dishonest I was with myself at times, and how I've met people who fool themselves and have admitted they fooled themselves about some ingredients that they just don't want to give up. You know, people also look for other people to give them their program, and they read books that tell them this is your problem, or they read plans that people say, well, it was good for me, it must be good for you. And our Dignity of Choice pamphlet makes it very clear that we have to find a plan of eating that's right for us, not that's right for someone else. Anyone who tries to force on me a plan of eating is trying to force me something that might work for that person, but not for me. And there are all kinds of things I can eat that people can't eat. Some people in this program can't eat, and some things that I can eat that I can't eat that some people can eat. There may be an overlap, a big overlap, but it's not the same for everyone. And the group conscience of OA, as represented by the Dignity of Choice pamphlet, says that very clearly, that we should not accept someone else's plan of eating unless we know that it works for us. At any rate, we have to abstain. But abstaining isn't going to do it for us, because our mind is going to get us back to that stuff sooner or later. It's going to give us every excuse in the world until finally it's going to give us a stupid excuse that will somehow work. Oh, they made it for me. Okay. You know, I can't have it. I can't have it. I can't have it. Have some. Okay. You know, it's just sort of like, and that's my life. So step 2 is simply giving us hope. We don't take step 1. We don't take step 2. We look at them and we know I'm doomed. And there's hope. And step 3 is a simple decision. I'm going to do this thing. I'm just going to do it. And step 3 gets us into the process of steps 4 through 9, which will give us the recovery that we seek. And from the Big Book perspective, steps 4 through 9 are the inventory process, even though the word inventory only appears in steps 4 through 9 in step 4. The inventory that's described in the Big Book is an inventory in which we both identify and get rid of the things that are worthless in us, that are causing us our problem. And it's very clear as we read the Big Book, and as we just finished off this morning about doing step 7, I mean, step 6 and 7 are such short steps. They're just steps you do the same day you do step 5 from the Big Book perspective. Because they're only little way stations on the road to recovery. And the Big Book makes this very clear when it says, now we need more action, right after step 7 on page 76, without which we find that faith without works is dead. And the Big Book repeats the faith without works is dead quite often. I don't know how many times. I'm sure there's some Big Book thumper who knows how many times, but I don't know how many times. Let me count. No. Because I memorized the Big Book, of course. Step four and five is where we identify. Step four is where we do it ourselves, and the Big Book provides a method of doing it that I identified this morning and I described this morning. And by the way, anyone who wasn't here this morning or didn't get the name, there is a website called oabigbook, all one word, .info. It's www.oabigbook.info, which contains a whole bunch of forms. I didn't draw them up, but they were given to me and I allowed to be used by an AA-er who has really studied the Big Book. They're about as close to the Big Book as I've ever seen any set of forms that have given me a lot of recovery and have given a lot of people I know a lot of recovery. And I know there are people in this room who have used them and who agree with me on that. They're wonderful forms for step four, and they're just great. So I won't repeat the instructions, but just from the background, from those forms, we find that we have 4 major character defects from the Big Book perspective, not the 20 or 30 or 100 that often other inventories disclose to us. We have 4. Selfishness, which ultimately comes down to I want life to be different. Dishonesty, which ultimately comes down to life isn't different. life is, and you better accept it. And you better not lie to yourself or lie to others or not tell the truth to others. Self-seeking is it's all about me. Somehow it all reflects on how I feel about myself, and fear, full of fear. And then we deal with our fears and we deal with our selfishness, dishonesty, and self-seeking in the other 2 forms on fears and sex conduct. But I'm just a pointer that that's what we do. In step 5, we share that with another human being. And from that human being, we get a sense of just the relief of confession. Secondly, we get the sense of we're not alone, which is, I can't tell you how important that was for me. You know, I talked last night about my first OA meeting where it took me 3 minutes to realize I wasn't alone. I didn't know how it was possible that other people got fat, as fat as or fatter than I was, but I didn't think anyone ate like me. And when I heard them tell their stories, I realized now I'm part of a group. I'm not on the outside looking in. I'm part of something. And my first step 5 and hell, all my other step 5s have been experiences in which I've realized I'm not alone, that there are other people out there and that they have the same feelings that I do. So it's a wonderful feeling. And the third reason that step 5 is very good, is very helpful, is that I get feedback from the other person as to whether I'm being too hard on myself or too easy on myself. I ask for that feedback and I get it. The best reason for doing step 5 is contained in the Big Book, which is that if we don't do it, we'll die. And so I take this program pretty seriously. So we do step 5 and then we with another human being, and then we also go home and we spend some time and we meditate upon what we've done and whether we've been complete. And if we are complete, then we ask ourselves, are we ready to have our defects of character removed? Well, I can tell you that my experience with these forms and having only 4 character defects, my experience is I'm always ready to have those 4 defects removed because they permeate my entire existence. And step 7, but if I'm not ready, I guess I wait until I'm ready. But you know what? It doesn't actually say wait until you're ready. It just says say a prayer. if we still cling to something, we will not go. We ask God to help us be willing. Bang. The big book discusses it very briefly. And then it goes, when ready, we say something like this, my creator, you know, we say the step seven prayer. I don't think there's much to that. I mean, there's a lot to it. It's important that I realize I'm ready. It's important that I ask. But what's really important is steps 8 and 9. And here's what the big book says on page 76. Now we need more action without which we find that faith without works is dead. So it's clearly, you're not going to have these defects of character removed from you by waiting at step 7 and waiting until your defects of character are removed so you can now go out into the world and be a different person. You're going to make yourself into a different person. You're going to be reborn. You're going to be a different person by making amends to other people and by doing so, becoming a different person. The ultimate issue of what an amend is I am no longer the person who did that to you, but I take full responsibility for what I did. But I'm not, God willing, I'm not that anymore. And that's the ultimate essence of responsibility. I take responsibility for what I've done, and I'm making the changes that are necessary for me not to do that again. What more can you say to anyone or do other than making up for the exact harm? So let's look at steps 8 and 9. The big book discusses them as a whole. And the reason for that, I think, is that they only existed as a whole before Bill Wilson wrote the 12 steps down. As I told most of you who were here this morning, there were originally only 6 steps. And step 8 and 9 was just made up for the harms we had done, made restitution for the harms we had done. But obviously, when you have people who are making up for the harms they've done, they would be working in AA. They'd be working with people who had had experience with that, and these people would say, "Now listen, don't be crazy. You know, don't apologize to someone who, if you apologized, they would be hurt even more. Don't make an amend that would harm someone else." But Bill found it important because he was writing again a do-it-yourself manual for people who did not have AA in their vicinity. That's the purpose. When this book started to be written, there were 40 AAers. When it was finished, there were approximately 100. And they were in New York, Brooklyn mostly, but New York, Akron, Ohio, and Cleveland, Ohio, by the time the book was published. It was impossible for AAers to carry the message one by one to many people. And this book was designed as a do-it-yourself manual. So Bill had to break the steps down to make sure that it could be digested easily and that there were no loopholes. And he actually says that in AA Comes of Age, that wonderful history of AA that he wrote. So step 8 and 9 break down this whole idea of restitution into two pieces. The first is we make a list of all persons we had harmed and we're ready to make amends to all of them. And the second is we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Not us, but injure them or others. And the big book discusses these two concepts, and it's very important to have these two concepts in mind. I don't think I have to emphasize how important it is. It's pretty obvious. Our OA 12 and 12 has a wonderful example of, I'll give you the example, then I'll talk about it. Mom, I just called to tell you that I've hated you for 20 years, but I love you now. Well, that's not necessarily an amend one should make. If your mother didn't know you hated her for 20 years, what's the value of telling her you hated her for 20 years? You know, and that's a good example. And I have my own example in my own life where I made an amend that actually backfired badly, and I'm much more careful now about making amends than when I did this one. I may have time to tell you about that. So the big book goes on, and it says, let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. So from the big book perspective, you don't burn your inventory at the end of step 5. You keep it because it tells you exactly where you've done harm. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol or over our binge foods. I like to talk about my binge foods or my killer foods because it's not all food. All food isn't cunning, baffling, and powerful for me. You know, I mean, radishes have never baffled me. Actually, two days ago, I actually had a roasted radish. It tasted really good. I hadn't had a radish for years because I hated radishes, but the roasted radish, very good. So the big book discusses amends in particular ways. And the first set of discussions, it discusses them in terms of direct amends and the kinds of direct amends we can make. Then it goes back to those same kinds of amends and discusses them in terms of whether harm would be done if we did them. So first it talks about the kind of amends we make, and then it goes into whether or not we always have to consider whether each of those kinds of amends might harm someone else and what we do about that, what kind of guidance we can get. So the first set of harms, the first set of amends, is found at the bottom of page 76. And it is basically the normal, the obvious amend, which is a direct apology. It's just saying, I have done wrong. God save me. I won't do this again. I am sorry for what I have done. I will make up for it however I can. And they talk about that. They give you guidance on how to do that. We don't emphasize a spiritual feature in our first approach. They say at the top of page 77, at the moment we're trying to put our lives in order. And listen to this. This is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. We now find that we came in order to lose weight or gain weight or to stop our eating problem, and we find that the only solution to that is to become useful to other people and to our higher power. It's the only solution that we have found. And it means, you know, when the big book talks about it right at the end of trudging the road to happy destiny, trudging, don't let anyone fool you. There's no dictionary that will tell you the word trudge means walk with a purposeful step, which I've heard some people say. It means walk with a weary step. It means we can't rest. It happens to be fulfilling. It happens to be one of the greatest things I've ever done in my life. But it's tough work because we can't stay still. We have to fit ourselves to be maximum service, not just minimum service. It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the prize room, this would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message. So, 77, still, we go to people even we dislike in a helpful, forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. And here are the real issues here. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell him that we will never get over drinking, compulsive eating, until we've done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so, never trying to tell him what he should do. I'm on at the top of page 78. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the result. Now, it's important to hear this. We will be gratified with the result. The next paragraph says, in 9 cases out of 10, they'll come over to your side and they'll try and help you and they'll be nice to you, but they may kick you out of the office. But it doesn't matter. You'll be gratified with the result because you will have unburdened yourself. And how you do it, I'll talk about that a little later, but that's the first part, a direct amend. Now, let me talk a bit about that, because there are some people, like I've been harmed by other people, and many of us in OA certainly feel as if we've been victimized rather than being the victimizers. We're victims more than victimizers. I mean, I don't know how many people I've met who have looked at the big book and said, why the hell should I read that? He should have read it. You know, and a lot of people have felt, and I certainly have felt myself a victim much more. I felt myself the patsy. I felt myself the guy who was harmed in so many ways. I'm not saying I was, but that's how I saw myself. There's a famous cartoonist, I just blanked his name, but he's the guy who created the character of Casper Milk Toast. And there's a great cartoon of Casper Milk Toast. He's in the 20s or 30s guy. He's standing in a street corner in front of a building, and he's looking at his watch. It's raining. He's completely drenched. He says, you know, if he doesn't come in an hour, he can borrow that $100 from someone else. And sometimes I felt like that. But how have I harmed people who have harmed me? That's a serious question. And the big book doesn't discuss that, although I think inherent in the concept of what dishonesty is that dishonesty can be not telling the truth when the truth should be told. And very often I have harmed people by A, selfishness, expecting them to be other than who they were, thinking I could change them. Dishonest by thinking I could change them, thinking I could have an effect on them, thinking I could rescue them. Not telling the truth when the truth should have been told to them, like, I'm out of here. I mean, real simple, I'm out of here. Not saying, stop this. I'm not to be treated this way. And sometimes and then there's self-seeking. I can save. I can do it. You know? And fear, all kinds of fears relating to that. But the point is, if you recall when I discussed, step four and I discussed the concept of, the people who have harmed us being spiritually sick and having something wrong and being in some, and I said, they do harm to themselves. The more they harm us, the more they harm themselves. Sometimes people say and have accepted, and people have suffered, again, so much more than I have suffered in life. People have suffered things that I can fathom them, but I can't believe that they're still alive after having suffered from them. But they have been able to say to me that the harm that they ultimately did to that person was allowing that person to harm himself by having him harm them. Now, of course, what does that mean to an 8-year-old kid who's abused? What does an 8-year-old kid have to feel bad about? No, it's not feeling bad. We're trying to become different people. So the amend we sometimes have to make to people who have harmed us is not letting them harm us anymore. And there's a famous story, and I don't know how true it is. A friend of mine actually sent me a video of the person, and it turned out not to be true. But I still think there's a truth to it. So I'll just tell you. I'll tell it in more generic form. The way I have heard it is a woman is abducted as a teenager by a madman, and he horribly abuses her for 4 days, cuts off her arms, and leaves her for death. But she's discovered, and she's ultimately rescued. He's put in jail, and she's got prosthetic arms and stuff. And she's interviewed, I don't know how many years later, and she's asked this question, don't you hate that man? And she said, that man took 4 days out of my life, and I'm damned if he's going to take any more. And I understand that. I mean, I haven't been hurt I haven't been hurt anywhere near like her or anywhere near like a lot of the people I know in this program, but I'm maybe so sensitive that even slight hurts have caused me to eat over them, have caused me to, I mean, even the slightest rejection has been to me like a knife in the heart, knife through the heart, even though, I've had a really, generally, a pretty good life. So I understand that concept that these people are killing us. And the amend I made to Hitler was not to let him, kill me. You know, not to let him, I can't make a direct amend to him, thank God he's dead, but I'm not going to let the thought of him incapacitate me and paralyze me, because I'm just not going to let him continue to do me any harm. So I just want to give you those sort of basic concepts. So the first concept is the direct amend. And at its best is, I am sorry that I have done this to you. And then we'll go into the issue of whether saying that will do some harm, because it might very well do some harm, and I'll talk about that. The second kind of amend is found on page 78, with the paragraph that begins, most alcoholics owe money. And that's the amend of restitution. And there are all kinds of wonderful stories about people who owe $100,000, they pay it back $25 a month, and they feel good about it. All those wonder. I mean, they're not stories, they're true stories, they're true. But we make up for the harm that we've done by recreating what we can out of what we took or wasted or squandered or something of that sort. And that's called restitution. We simply make up for it. It's mostly connected often with an apology, but it is more than an apology because more is needed than an apology. You know, I'm sorry I stole $100,000 from you isn't much good to someone who's $100,000 out, right? So it's more than an apology. It includes an apology, but is more than that. So that's a restitution. I'm sorry for how I treated you, but at the same time, I'm going to pay you, or in some way help you to make up for what I have taken from you or caused you. I don't know how many of us have many of those things. I mean, I know a lot of people who have had to make amends to stores that they've stolen from, and you know, the little mom and pop store that they took candies from, and things of that sort. And I'll talk about how we do those amends in a minute. But the whole concept of it is restitution. The third kind that the Big Book talks about is found on page 78 again. Perhaps we have committed a criminal offense which might land us in jail if it were known to the authorities. We may be short in our accounts, unable to make good. Maybe it's only a petty offense such as padding the expense account. And here it is, an offense not just against a person, but against society in general. We've done harm that affects more than just the one person we can go to and make amends. But we've done a harm that offends more than one person. And we'll see another example of this when we get to the issue of whether harms will take place. But I'll use that example now. We may have ruined the reputation of another person. It's not good enough to go up to that person and say, I'm really sorry I ruined your reputation. Because his reputation or her reputation would still be ruined. So in some way, we have to make an amend in a sense to society. We have to take public responsibility for the harms that we've done in order to make up for the harm that we've done. It may be as simple as, I've committed a criminal offense, I have to take public responsibility for committing that criminal offense, or it may be as subtle as, I have harmed the reputation of an individual, and I have to resurrect that person's reputation because to other people, not to him or her. Those are the three kinds of direct amends, and when you think about it, there probably aren't any other kinds of direct amends. One is to the individual, one goes beyond that and makes up for what has been done, and the third goes to society in general. I mean, that's the gamut, not much else. So these three direct amends are then picked up by the Big Book with the issue of whether harm will be done. And on page 79, they say, although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. So, you know, there are all kinds of reparations we can make. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. That's a general guiding principle. Okay? Usually, however, other people are involved. Therefore, we are not to be the hasty and foolish martyr who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit. So we have to be sure, we have to figure out what our amend is. I mean, first of all, we have to figure out what the harm we've done. Until we know what harm we've done, we can't figure out what kind of amend to make. So first of all, what is the harm I've done to this person? He or she may have harmed me more than I've harmed him or her. What kind of an amend do I owe? And it may be a combination of things. It may be an apology, but it may be something more than that. There's a person to whom I should have said many years ago, you are a sick person, you need psychiatric help, and until you get it, I can't have anything to do with you. I'm willing to help you very much, but I can't have anything to do with you because you're harming me and you're harming yourself as a result of harming me. You're getting worse, not better. If 30 years from now I happen to see that person, am I going to say, you know, I'm really sorry I didn't tell you how sick you were 30 years ago? No. I mean, how could I? You know, but I'm ready to do it, but I can't do it. So the Big Book talks now about harms, and they go back to the same kinds of examples with those three different kinds of direct amends. The first one they deal with is a person who owes money, who, if he paid back the money, would starve his family. That would do harm to others. What does he do? He meditates, he prays, he consults with the family, and he finally writes to the person he owes, his ex-wife, and says, I can't pay the whole thing because that would harm my current family, but I will pay off in pieces, whatever it's called. I've lost the words. Pardon me? Installments. Thank you. And they say that's one way of dealing and balancing these issues. And again, you always have to balance. I mean, if you saw a kid about to jump off a cliff, and the only way you could save that kid would be to break his, you know, hold his arm and thus break it. You'd break his arm, because better break his arm than have him die, right? So sometimes you have to balance the kind of amends you make based on the harm you would do, the relative harm and the relative good you would do. It's not easy. But that's the first one. So it's on the same order I just gave it to you, but the first one they deal with is the restitution, the paying back of the money that is owed. The second example they give, it's, I think, probably the worst passage in the big book. I think the chapter to the wives is probably the worst. But by the way, how many of you know that the chapter to the wives was not written by wives? It pretends to be written by wives, but in fact, Bill wrote it. And Bill's wife, Lois, the co-founder of Al-Anon, was furious with him. Why don't you let me write it? Well, I needed consistency of writing, he said. And yet he still allowed Hank to write the chapter to the employers. Anyway, the next example they give, and I don't love this example because there's all kinds of unspoken things here. They say, right on the top of page 80, before taking drastic action which might implicate other people, we secure their consent. If we have obtained permission, if we consulted with others, ask God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, we must not shrink. This brings to mind a story by one of our friends, and this is the story of a guy who borrowed money from a business rival who then denied that he had borrowed it and brought discredit to the reputation of the business rival in his community. How was he to do it? If he confessed it now, he worries that he might harm his current business partner and harm his family. Should he do it? He consults with them, and he decides he has to do it. So far, so good. I like that. He gets up in church, and he admits it. Must have been an interesting church that allowed that. But anyway, he gets up in church and admits it, and everyone says it's wonderful. And he's now the backbone of the community. That's okay. Did he ever pay the money back? That's what I want to know. You know, it really bothers me. But anyway, that is an example of the harm that has to be publicly dealt with, the amend that has to be done publicly. If he harms someone's reputation, it's no good to apologize to that person or even pay that person money. You have to take some public responsibility for it. But it might have been that he would have harmed too many people in doing that, and therefore he doesn't do it. And the third example is the example of a direct amend. Will you harm other people if you make a direct apology? Okay, remember that we had apology, restitution, and public responsibility. Now, it's not quite the same order, but we're dealing with restitution, public responsibility, right? And now we're dealing with apology. And this is an example they use. This is a very complex example of a man who is committing adultery. Does he tell his wife? Some of you may be cynical enough to believe that Bill Wilson actually considered these issues very carefully, because there's some thought that, depending, there's no evidence of it, but there sure is a lot of rumor about whether Bill himself was, in his later years, a real philanderer. And if he was, maybe Lois knew about it. Maybe they had an arrangement. I don't know. But at any rate, Bill never wanted to be a hero. He wrote a great article called "Why Can't Dr. Bob and I Be Members of AA?" You know, which was basically saying, "I don't want to be put up on a pedestal." But people do. They call him. They think of him as a god. He wasn't. He was a very inspired man when he wrote this book. But he wasn't necessarily the greatest man in the world. He certainly saved my life. But it doesn't mean that he was perfect. Anyway. Do you tell your wife, do you tell your spouse that you've had an affair? And the answer they give is no. It might very much well harm her. Why would you tell someone something that would harm that person? You have to stop doing it. You have to rededicate yourself to your marriage. But why would you tell someone something that would cause pain? And that's a lesson that I had to learn. I mean, I'd made some apologies and the instigation of one of my earlier sponsors, which did backfire on me, and I just wasn't sensitive enough to that issue. And I know other people who have done things that they do regret, telling me that. But I gossiped about a guy. I think I might have mentioned that I did. And it would have been of no value to him, because he didn't know about it, to say, I made statements, I told true stories about you, and they were all true stories, and thus held you up to ridicule, I am sorry, I won't do it again. The amend I make to that person, because I think that would harm him, is to say, anytime people try to tell stories about that person, I used to tell stories about them, but I don't think it's nice and good to tell stories about them. We're getting cool air now.
Yeah,
it's now cool. It's cool now.
Oh, okay, that's what I thought. It feels cool.
Feels cool now, yeah.
Thank you, though.
Thank you. For the purpose of the people on the tape, we just had a visit about the heating. By the way, I didn't usually when I'm being taped, I like to describe the room I'm in and stuff. And we're in a nice square room in the hotel, and there are about 400 people here, I think. Very well. Okay. So I say to people, when they start gossiping about this person, I used to gossip them, but I decided it wasn't a good thing to do because really I think we're just making fun of a particular weakness that person has. I think he's not that well, and I don't think it's funny to make fun of him. I can be a real party pooper, but that's what I do. And I don't gossip about him, and I make my amends by trying to explain. I mean, the things that he does are only funny if you have no interest in him as a human being. If you're interested in him as a human being, they're not funny. They're examples of a kind of a sickness in him that really aren't funny. So that's what I do. So those are the three examples. They go into quite a lot of detail about the thing. They say, if your wife does know, do you apologize? Well, you might say, you're right, but it's not happening again, but you give no details because you have no right to involve another person. And you don't want jealousy to arise, that. You just don't talk about it. And they do say, perhaps on page 82, there are some cases where the utmost frankness is demanded. No outsider can appraise such an intimate situation. But they talk about that. So those are the direct amends. Apology, restitution, public responsibility, that they discuss again under different examples, but they discuss again on the question of whether harm would result. And that's the big book approach to direct amends. There's a whole bunch of other, there's a whole area of another amend, and that's what they call living amends. And we call living amends, but page 82. If we have no such complications, there's plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only things he needs to do is to keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But he's yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he's so shockingly treated. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead. That's a little bit more dramatic than I think that many of us have been. I think we're more like a blob of gelatin rolling its way around and around, slowing everything down, and, I don't know. At any rate, on page 83, there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. So a direct apology or restitution or public responsibility won't fill the bill with people we live with. We ought to sit down with the family, frankly analyze the past, as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. We clean house with the family. They go on, the spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. So for those with whom we live, and when I say live, I don't mean just in the same house, but those with whom we have an ongoing relationship, the kind of amend we have to make to them is far beyond, I'm sorry. They've heard that from us before. Certainly my wife heard that from me many times before. I have to change. If I don't change and live a spiritual life, I'll just do the same thing over and over again. So living amends is stressed in the big book as something that we must think about doing. Our people we work with, people we know, people we spend time with, an apology isn't enough because we have harmed them in some way, at least if we have harmed them. And then the last set is there may be harms, some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves we would right them if we could. So the person to whom I should have said, you're a sick person, you need a psychiatrist, I'm ready any time to talk to that person, but I'm never going to initiate that conversation. I have some ex-girlfriends I'd love to apologize to, but I'm not going to say, hey, remember me from 40 years ago or 45 years ago? Remember what I did to you? I'm really sorry. What's the value of that? I have no idea what situation they're in or what their life is like. And I had one bad example with that I don't ever want to have repeated. it's too complicated to get into. It's not really that important. Basically, it was just sort of like I just wasn't sensitive to the situation of sort of zooming down into someone's life. So, but I'm ready. I mean, if the person who I think should have seen the psychiatrist ever said to me, you know, I really acted weird in those days. I'm really sorry for what I did. And I probably would find some way of saying, you know what? I'm not sure I was a good friend of yours because I'm not sure that I was able to talk to you in a way that was able to show you that you needed help. Instead, I just took what you gave me without protest. And I think that was not a nice thing for me to do. And I'm very sorry, too. That would be a nice conversation. If I ever see one of my ex-girlfriends, I know where some of them live, and I might go to that town someday and I might say, can we have coffee? And I might just talk to them. I might find the right words to say. I might be able to say, not remember that time when I, but I might say, you know what, I look at you with a lot of fondness. I'm sorry if anything I ever did hurt you because I really have tried to be a better person. And that might be enough. Might not be, but I'm sure they're not going to zoom in on them and say, hey, sorry, you know. So that's the message. Now, there's so many different kinds of amends that people make that it's hard to sort of go through all of them. I have a few minutes. I'll talk. I have three friends who were all victims of sexual abuse of some kind. And they each one of them had different amends that they made. One of them went to the police after many years and said, this man did this to me, and got that person arrested and testified against that person. Another said, you know what, he's 92 years old, he's decrepit, he's dying, he's decaying. I'm not going to do anything. It's of no value whatsoever. He's no danger to society. He's a sick old man, and I'm over him. And my amend to him is not to let this get to me anymore. And the third one, it was an uncle, went to a family gathering and announced at the family gathering, I'm not letting my children near this man. And I want you to know why. Had been silent for all those years. And that, for her, was a tremendous release. Who's to say? People write letters and burn them. People go to the graves and put the letters on, rip them up and put them on. I've had conversations with dead people in which I apologize to them. I've imagined them. I don't. I'm not a psychic. So I've had conversations like that with them, and that's been wonderful. I mean, I had to make an amend to my grandparents for something, and they were long gone, and I remember. And I apologized to them, and immediately I knew what they would say. I knew them so well that I knew that they said it was okay. A friend of mine in the program ran out of a restaurant in India, in a small town in India, because they were angry with the service, never paid, been on her mind for years. Couldn't even remember the name of the restaurant, didn't know whether it existed. Found an OA group in that place, sent them money. You know, years ago, I was responsible for photocopying something, and I buggered it up in 300 pages. I was so negligent. I was photocopying a book, and I didn't realize that I had the wrong angle on it. And I never admitted it, even though there was a meeting called for people to admit it. You know, I was working in this library as a page in a library. I sent them money. You know, these are things I've apologized to people. One of the things that I have learned. And this is different from what other people have said in big book studies that I've listened to. And I find it very interesting. And I give you only my experience, and I'll tell you what they say. They say, whether you believe it or not, make the apology. And they say, it comes. And that's their advice, and I'm sure that for them it worked. For me, what I have found is that when I'm ready, when I pray to know what it is to be said and let it go, that I know that I say what's right. In other words, if I know the harm that I've done to a person, and I know the kind of amend I have to make, that if I'm in that space, the amend I make is a good one. It's heard by them, and I'm ready to move with whatever happens. My mind is open because I'm only looking at their own good and not at mine. And I can tell you a story which I don't know if I told in my Camp Houston talk, but it's a very instructive story. I tell it not just for the purpose of Step 9, but also to show how I am no poster boy. 1 year into the program, I was really working the program hard. I was really quite recovered. Things were really working well. My wife wanted to buy a new house. And we just spent a lot of time and effort renovating our old one. It was a nice, wonderful house. The kids were well settled. We had a good school. But this house was on the river, and my wife wanted, she loves the sea. She loves the water. And it was a big river that goes through Winnipeg. And the house was smaller than our house, and it cost more because it was on the river. And I started to get my dander up. I got so angry at her. And I said, no, I can't afford this. I really have to work this through. So I said to her, you know what, I'll tell you what I think tomorrow, but I don't really know what I think. I'm going to have to pray and meditate most of the night. So I'll see you in the morning, and I'm going to... And then what I did was I read all the AA and OA literature that I had. This is a long time ago. There wasn't as much, but I had a lot of it. And I read it all. I was up until 2 in the morning, maybe 3 in the morning. I went to sleep. She was asleep already. And I woke up the next day, and she was looking at me. She's lying in bed just looking at me, waiting for me to get up. And I had no idea what I was going to say. No idea whatsoever, because I hadn't planned anything, but I had some trust that what came out of my mouth would be right. I said to her, you know what? I don't know whether we can afford it or not. I don't know whether it's the right decision for us, whether we can sell the house, our current house, for what it is, And so we really have a lot to discuss, whether it's really what we want in our lives. But I'll make you this promise. I will never blame you. If we decide to buy that house, I will never blame you. It will be our decision, not your decision. She melted at that. That was more what she wanted to hear than, yes, we'll buy the house. And we ended up buying the house. But what impressed me about that moment was the fact that it just came. And those of you who are more religious will say you were tuned into God. And I understand that. And I was tuned into God in even my sense that there was nothing between my values of truth and love and justice and beauty, nothing between those values and my mind. And I was speaking with those values in mind for her good, not for me. I was being more sensitive because I wasn't thinking about myself. So however you want to characterize it, that's what happened. Two things from that story. One is that I told that story at my OA meeting, and a woman came up to me, and a woman who lived on social assistance, on welfare, and said, you're so right. You know, faith will do for you what you can't do for yourself. I ran out of money with 3 days to go before I would get some more money. I needed $20, and I prayed, and then someone phoned me and wanted to buy some knitting for me for $20. I know exactly how you feel. And I thought, oh, God, I'm talking about $100,000, and she's talking about $20, and she knows exactly how I feel. This is OA. I mean, this is what a feeling to have that. But the sad part is, that's the reality of life, and it's something I'll talk about when I get to Step 10 after the break. My wife and I were driving, this about 10 years ago. My wife and I were driving somewhere, and I suddenly started to blame her for the purchase of the house. I went on and on for about 20 minutes telling her, you know, we'd be so much happier if we hadn't moved, da-da-da-da-da-da. And suddenly, after 20 minutes of this, I remembered my promise. Boy, did I have to make amends for that. But it just shows you, if you aren't practicing this program all the time, or if I'm not practicing this program all the time, I can go back easily. I'm just a day away from this. I'm a bite away from losing my absence. I'm a bite away from losing my spirituality. I'm a thought away from losing my spirituality. I'll pick that up when we get to step 10. So I'll just end by reading you two sets of promises that come. One is the set of promises that comes halfway through this phase of our development, the famous promises. We read them yesterday, but let's read them again. Here's the real promise of step 9. This is the spiritual awakening that we're going to get. If we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through step 9. Halfway through step 9. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They're being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. But the set of other promises that come at the end of Step 9 actually are at the bottom after the discussion of Step 10, but they're the promises of Step 9. By this time, we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even our killer foods. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in our killer foods. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. The bottom, page 84. And now I'm at the top of page 85. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward our killer foods has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off and said the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. I'm going to stop at that point. There's another sentence which I'll pick up in, when I deal with step 10. But the key to that is, if that hasn't happened for you at the end of step 9, then start thinking about what you haven't done in the steps. Because that is the promise. That is the spiritual awakening. That is the thing that I came to this program for, that I would no longer be troubled by food that used to beckon to me. And that's the promise of step 9 in the Big Book. Okay, we'll break and we'll come back and talk step 11.